Welcome to the Westgear Support Technical Exchange. Today's topic is KICS Web Services, Structure, and Debugging. Today's presenter is Charlie Veazey. Charlie is a software engineer with application and integration middleware technical support IBM software, and has been a member of the KICS Level 2 support team since 2003, where he specializes in KICS Web Services. Prior to his current role, he has since 1986 installed and supported KICS in various customer environments. At this time, I would like to turn the presentation over to Charlie.
Thank you, Joseph. Okay, we're going to spend the next hour or so talking about web services. The original title of this pitch was Web Services Debugging, but I realized actually some comments from some coworkers that saw this presentation that there was enough time spent on non-debugging topics that were really important for the debugging feature that I should really try to reflect that in the title, and hence we have structure and debugging. We're going to take you a little bit into structure. I think it's really important to understand web services structure in order to have a logical approach to debugging. But we have a lot of material to cover and a little bit of time to cover it, so we're going to try and push through this pretty quick. On slide two, I have some disclaimers and acknowledgments, various trademarks that are used in this presentation. And on slide three is our agenda. Now, we're going to spend a little bit of time, as I said, talking about web services from an overview standpoint, some of the processing flow and requirements. We're going to talk about web services from the standpoint of resource definitions and the configuration files that support those definitions. Going to take a little bit of time to talk about how to avoid problems, because if you can avoid problems, then that's one more problem that you don't have to debug. So avoiding problems and dodging pitfalls, just a little bit of talk about that. We're going to spend some time talking about how to identify your problems, and once you've identified what your problem is, how to get documentation for that. Some techniques for diagnosis, especially talking about verb exits and working with traces and some of the gold mining that you can do looking through your traces. And then finally, we'll hopefully apply some of what we've learned and look at some sample problems and show you how that can be a very useful technique for figuring out what's going on with your web services.
And moving on to slide number four.
Terrific. Thank you, Joseph. Okay, well, this is a title page leading us into our processing overview, so let's go right ahead into slide five. We're going to spend a minute talking about this, and most of you that are not new to web services have probably seen this chart before. It represents a standard depiction of the processing that KICS performs when web services, or in this instance, a service provider, is doing its processing. So we're going to focus more closely on the KICS resource definitions and the related files that describe and support web services. Starting from the top in the center, you'll see the TCP/IP service resource. This is used to define each port that you use for CICS as an HTTP server, including security options for connections on that port and timeout and maximum size limits for inbound requests. These are defined only for incoming socket data, and they inform KICS which port to listen on, as well as defining the transaction you want to use to handle that data. The default is CWXN, as you see here. The CSOL transaction you see depicted just to the left is actually supplied by KICS, and it functions as the socket's listener task, which detects inbound TCP/IP connection requests. It's a long-running KICS task. There's one instance of the socket's listener task in a KICS system. Next, we're going to talk about pipeline resource, which is a little bit lower towards the middle of the chart. This is the resource type that ties a particular web service together. It provides information about the message handler programs that act on a service request and on the response. A pipeline definition provides information about an infrastructure that can be used by many applications. The information about the processing nodes is supplied indirectly by the pipeline configuration file, which is depicted towards the left in the HFS files box. This is a ZOS Unix file. It contains an XML description of the nodes and their configuration. Now, there are two flavors of pipeline definitions, which describe either a service provider or a service requester configuration. One of the optional parameters in a pipeline resource is the pickup directory specified in the WSDIR parameter. The web service binding directory contains web service binding files that are associated with a pipeline and that are to be installed automatically by the CICS scanning mechanism. When the pipeline definition is installed, KIX scans the directory and automatically installs any web service binding files it finds there. Now, looking above the pipeline definition on the chart, you'll see the URI map. The URI map resource definitions match the URIs of requests to an HTTP server and provide KIX with information on how to process those requests, including the transaction name to use for the web services provider. This defaults to CPIH, which you see to the right side of the chart. Now, the web service definition, or resource, which is depicted at the bottom of the center of that chart, defines aspects of the runtime environment for a KIX application program deployed in a web services setting where the mapping between the application data structure and the SOAP request has been generated using the KIX web services assistant. Although customers can define web services manually, these are normally dynamically installed. Although you can also statically define the URI map and web service definitions, most customers permit KIX's dynamic install processing to generate those definitions when they perform the pipeline install. Now, on slide 6, I'm depicting the different interrelationships between the various resources that make up a web service definition. The KIX Web Services Assistant utility will produce a WSDL file from a language structure or copybook, or a language structure from a WSDL. They'll go either direction. Now, as part of the generation process, a web service binding file is also produced. That's the WS bind file. A WS bind file contains information about the KIX program to be invoked, the name of the WSDL file, the local URI, and information necessary to populate a COM area from XML, and vice versa. Both the WS bind and WSDL files will be used by the executing KIX region. The URI map definition will name both the pipeline definition and the web service definition. The pipeline resource definition will copy the installed web service definitions to its shelf. The web service definitions can be dynamically created through use of the pickup directory, that's the WSDIR parameter. The web service definition will name the pipeline definition that contains the configuration information, the config file, on which message handlers are invoked when processing this web service. Now on slide 7, we're depicting the mapping of a SOAP body to a COM area. A message handler in the pipeline, and typically this is the KIX supplied SOAP message handler, would remove the SOAP envelope from an inbound request and pass the SOAP body to the data mapper function. This uses the web service binding file, the WS bind file, to map the contents of the SOAP body to the application's data structure. In other words, that's how the translation takes place between a SOAP body and a COM area or a container. The execution environment that allows a particular CICS application program to operate in a web services setting is defined by three objects that we've already talked about. It's the pipeline, the web service binding file, or WS bind file, and the web service description, or WSDL. These three objects are defined to KIX as attributes of the web service resource definition. Now to slide 8. So the reason that we wanted to talk about structure and flow is that it can be a useful tool, an important technique, to helping to diagnose web service-related problems. And as we get into this presentation a little bit more, I'm going to show you some trace techniques that will help you to follow that structure and flow and to see what's going on with your web services application and where it's breaking if it is not working correctly. Okay, on slide 9, we have a brief overview, in this case of a provider, web services provider flow, where we talk about, okay, so here's the application, here's the request coming in. CSOL, that long-running CICS-provided task, the listener task, is going to detect the incoming socket data from TCP/IP, and it's going to attach whatever the appropriate transaction, the default CWXN transaction, to obtain the actual incoming data. CWXN is going to kick off. It receives the data, performs URI matching to figure out what kind of a request this is, and then, in the case of web services, we'll attach a CPIH transaction to process web services requests. The CPIH transaction does the work of the web services. It creates the pipeline, creates the containers, calls the handlers that have been defined to the pipeline, parses the incoming XML data, and maps that into a COM area or into containers, links to the terminal handler, which is the web services application program to actually satisfy the request, and then goes through the reverse, transforms the COM area or container back into XML, converts it, sends the socket data back to the service requester. Now on slide 10, I have also provided a flow overview of the requester. As you can imagine, it's sort of the back end of the web service request. In this case, the processing would start with an application program that would invoke a web service by issuing the execcis invoke web service command. Once that command is invoked, CACS is going to fill additional containers, it's going to configure and start the pipeline, and then it runs the pipeline. It runs the SOAP handler program, converting data, performs the socket send, and then turns right around and does a socket receive, awaiting the response from whoever the web service provider is outside of CICS. When the data comes back in, CICS is then going to parse that XML data that's returned from the web service call. It links to the SOAP 1.1 handler program, parses the provider's reply. It then relinquishes the pipeline, transforms the XML data, and then finally returns from the Invoke Web Service API. Okay, on slide 11, we talked a little bit about the resource definitions, and once again, I'm not going to spend a lot of time here. We've already touched on this information, but we have the TCP/IP service definition, which defines a port for the socket listener task to listen for incoming requests. We have HFS artifacts that make up the resource definitions, and that's the config file and the WSBind file. We have a pipeline definition, a pipeline resource, which defines the web service provider or requester. On to slide 12, we also have a URI map definition and a web service definition. Okay, slide 13 is just a header slide to get us into avoiding problems and pitfalls. There's actually another presentation that I did some time ago, starting on slide 14. There's a reference to that earlier presentation. Now, I think that I've really captured the meat of that presentation here, so I'm not sure that you really necessarily need to go and listen to that entire presentation. But if you'd like to, here's a reference to it. The tech note 701-2643 will direct you to that old Web Services Technical Exchange presentation that I did last year. The number one recommendation, obviously, is to check your maintenance levels. This includes CICS modules as well as the mapping level parameter of the Web Services Assistant Utilities. We're going to talk about mapping level a little bit more later. But as Web Services is a fairly recent innovation for CICS processing, there has been a lot of maintenance. There's certainly been a lot of enhancement. And so that you're taking advantage of all the processing efficiencies and all the variety of processing that has been generated to support web services, we strongly encourage the latest maintenance levels. The next tip for you is to ensure that you have sufficient data set access. We see this a lot with people who have sort of skimmed by dealing with their HFS aspects of CICS. When you start working with web services, there's more of a need to integrate that, and people that have sort of gotten by with maybe a minimal knowledge of HFS, use of web services seems to step up that requirement to understand really what's going on with HFS, and we've seen data set access to be a problem here. Next, and I would say this is probably the number one suggestion that I would make to new customers who haven't really done anything with web services yet, is to install and test a supplied sample web services application. Now you'll see this defined in the CICS web services guide. I think it's chapter 15 of that manual. It describes the application, how it works, how it fits together, but also how you go about defining it in your region. And since that's supplied with CICS, since the code, the components, a known working quantity in web services is provided for you, it can really help to flush out sort of environmental problems or access problems by working on that known quantity, working on something that we know should work, without going to the trouble of writing your own web services application, just to make sure that the infrastructure is in place. So it's sort of a walk before you run approach, if you will. The Catalog Manager application is simple, but it does provide a very practical illustration of web services, and it can be set up to function as both a web service provider as well as a service requester. Okay, on to slide 15, please. Now, the Web Services Assistant, the batch piece that you can run to either generate a WSDL from your language structure or conversely to generate a language structure from a WSDL input. The first thing here that you need to know about is the mapping level. And if you haven't come across this before, it's kind of an interesting approach to maintenance where from a CICS maintenance standpoint, we try to make sure that your WSBind files are going to be compatible with each other, that they are going to be at a, let's say, at a common level. So in contrast to CICS maintenance, where perhaps you receive an APAR, a PTF, you apply your PTF, and the next time you recycle your CICS region, you're running at that latest level. With the Web Services Assistant, the approach is different, where you actually have to specify that you want to run at the higher level of maintenance. Now, when Web Services was first introduced at KixTS version 3.1, there wasn't actually a mapping level. But with the maintenance introduced by PK15904, a new attribute, a new parameter was introduced called mapping level. And at that APAR level, the mapping level assigned was 1.1. We then retroactively created this mapping level 1.0 to refer to the base 3.1 maintenance level for the WSA. As you can see by the chart, other maintenance have released additional processing levels, some additional performance enhancements with the Web Services Assistant, but you only get those levels when you specify the higher mapping level as you run the Web Services Assistant. Now the other recommendation here at the bottom of the chart is to verify that you're using the correct input parameters, and this is a simple example. It's invalid to specify a program name if you're defining a web service requester. In other words, if you're the requester, you don't know who the program is. That's not your concern. The web service requester, web service assistant, would only be concerned with what the endpoint is and what the format of the data is. So be aware of the parameters that make sense for whether you're coding a requester or a provider, but also be aware of the case-sensitive parameters because the web services assistant is case-sensitive. Okay, on slide 16, please. One of the things I wanted to mention here that we've seen certainly some impact from, a number of customers are quite concerned over the performance aspect of the Kix Web Services Assistant. Well, two things I would say about this. First of all, your LA configuration, the default, probably isn't configured too well to run the Web Services Assistant, which is basically just a Java program. It doesn't run that very efficiently. There's a lot of paging, and so with the override parameters that I've provided in this sample, you can see significant decreases in execution time for your Web Services Assistant. The other thing that I would call to your attention, though, is keep in mind that when you're defining your Web Services application, your Web Services Assistant really only runs once. I mean, if you make enhancements, if you make modifications to the web service itself, obviously you're going to have to rerun that Web Services Assistant to get a WSBind file, a WSDL, and a language structure that are all matching once again so that your web service will continue to execute. But you're really only running that one time. Don't be too hung up over the performance aspect of this batch job that has to do with configuring or installing a web service. And it's a little bit like being concerned about your SMPE job that takes, you know, maybe an hour and a half to run to do the CICS install. You're only doing the Kix install once, and there's a lot of work that's going on in the background to accomplish that. Okay, more about deployment errors. Now, some of the other deployment errors that we see are unusable WSDLs, unsupported features, or perhaps you're unable to install a pipeline or a web service resource. And there's actually an example later in this presentation, just something to keep in mind, that just because an install of, for example, a pipeline is completed, doesn't mean that the install was successful. And we'll talk in more detail about that in just a couple minutes. Now, you can use CEMT to inquire against the status of the resources to see if they're installed, to see if they're actually accessible, if they're usable. And for diagnosis in this area, if you're experiencing problems, normally you'd look for messages in your logs, and probably you would trace your install with trace parameters. You'd specify all the tracing active at level 1, except for the PI, the pipeline domain, which normally you'd want to see at 1-2. On the next slide, we'll spend a little bit of time talking about some runtime problems. Now, web services is not a browser technology. Web services is a technique for program-to-program communication across the web. That's the basic design, and browsers don't really understand that. A browser is more of an HTML or a PP, whatever plugins that you have, but a browser is a browser. It displays data that you're looking at from a site. It's a different concept than what web services gives you, which is program-to-program communication. So people that try to use browsers to access their web service are missing the point a little bit. You need something that's going to make a web service request of your web service provider, and a browser doesn't understand how to do that. Okay, some of the other common runtime problems that we see. If your response time is consistently longer than you expected, this can be caused by the TCP/IP delay acknowledgement or delay acts parameter. You can code the no delay acts in your TCP/IP config statement as a TCP configuration, not a CICS configuration aspect. Now, if you do code no delay acts, you can then go back and code delay acts to override that setting for specific ports, port ranges, other aspects. If your TCP/IP support staff say that they still need delay acts, you can still get no delay acts for your CICS environment if you find that that's causing some response delays. And there's further detail in a tech note that I've referenced there, number 1250026. Okay, one of the other common problems that we've seen, there's a message DFHPI 0602. That gives you the message, the KIX SOAP handler failed to parse a message. The parse error is, and there's an error code provided, as well as a return code. Now that's, the KIX SOAP handler program is using the PL1 XML parser, called the SAX parser, to process the contents of the SOAP message. A parsing error generates this message, and the explanation of the return code, you can look at the tech note number 1264885, for further details about how to understand that. Okay, on slide 18, there's some more information about runtime problems. Now, for data conversion errors, you're going to find after you've applied APAR PK23547, one of the following messages are also issued when you encounter a data conversion error, and that's going to be DFHPI 1007, 1008, 1009 or 1010. The possible causes are an invalid SOAP message or an out-of-range value. And once again, we've written a tech note to help you to diagnose that type of problem as well. And that's tech note number 1211424. Okay, now on slide 19, we talk about some of the common CICS and HFS file problems. We already mentioned the insufficient HFS dataset access problem. And you'll see it as in the example that I show below, the DFHPI 0705 message. Another error that you can see with your access to HFS files is if you have actually a corrupt HFS file. And where we've seen this happen sometimes is with the WSBind file, which can be generated by DRDZ or WDZ product. If you generate a WSBind file, which is actually a binary file, intended to be read by the machine. If you generate that on a non-ZOS platform, then when you send that to your KIX HFS directory, the ZOS directory, you need to make sure to transmit that file in binary form. Okay? If you send it in ASCII, then it's going to cause incorrect file translation, and it will corrupt the WSBind file, and KIX will not be able to use that. Okay, slide 20. We talk about our, we begin our discussion talking about how to identify problems and what type of documentation to gather. And on slide 21, runtime problems to identify. You can identify those problems through the add-ins that you get. I would say first and foremost, that would probably be where you'd be seeing them. But also, you might notice messages in your message user log, either CICS supplied messages, which you can use to determine what types of errors that you're receiving. The messages here can also give you an opportunity, though, to capture more specific documentation if Kix isn't already taking a dump at that point. And you can do that with the master terminal set system dump code command, CEMT set SYD, and you'd specify the error message number and the number of dumps that you'd want to take. Typically, if you haven't taken any dumps yet, you'd specify a maximum of one. The add just says to add this code to the system dump code table. So, for example, referring to an earlier slide, if we knew that we were getting message DFHPI0705 and that was the message that most closely correlated with the error that we need to further diagnose, then you could capture a dump, you could configure CICS to capture a dump on that DFHPI0705 message by coding the command CEMT set SYD open paren PI0705 close paren, and then the rest of the command as you see it there, max 1 and add. And that will tell CICS for the message DFHPI0705 to capture the next time that message is issued to capture a dump. Now, another place to look for how to identify the errors that you may be seeing is in the soap fault message. Now, that's useful both on requesters and providers. The soap fault message is actually provided in the response from a web service request, and it identifies errors that the web service provider encountered. One of the things we like to see at Level 2 support is if you can recreate the error. A lot of times, if we can't get any closer to the error, then we'll just ask the customer to run with aux trace and then to try to navigate the problem that way. And we're going to talk a little bit further later in this presentation about some useful commands, some handy ways for getting in and understanding what trace is trying to tell you. Okay, on slide 22, we'll talk a little bit about how to identify problems with your tooling. The tooling is really the batch side of this. It has to do with the web services assistant job. And normally you'd look in your job log in the sysprint listing for the batch job. But you might also want to have a look at the HFS error file, the error log, that's specified in the log file parameter of the batch job that you ran. Now, one of the things that we strongly encourage our customers to do is to validate their WSDLs with Eclipse. Now, CICS can only provide that level of compatibility or support for WSDL processing that are generally recognized and understood anyway. And so what we found is that with WSDLs, if they don't validate under Eclipse, then they're not going to run under our batch tooling, under our web services assistant job. Now, you can use Eclipse for that validation. You can also use RDZ or WDZ to validate your WSDLs, but that can be very handy if you're encountering problems just processing your WSDL to make sure that you have something that's usable. We've certainly seen a number of vendors that have provided their customers, and actually our customers, with WSDLs that are supposed to be valid, but when they run it through sort of a generic third-party validation, such as Eclipse, they find that, in fact, the WSDL is not valid. And so that's a key starting place. Okay, on slide 23. So we've talked a little bit about triggering your system dumps by setting your system dump command. And there's a more specific example. If you wanted to capture DFHWB0723, then you could code your system dump table for that message. There are some alternatives that we talk about here as well, including slip traps or manually requesting a dump. Now, I would say a manual dump is probably the least amount of good, since typically it's not going to have information pertinent to the specific incident that you're concerned about just in a manual dump request. The only exception to that would be if you had a hung transaction, but normally a manually requested dump would have limited value. Now, if you can't get close to your problem and you find that an aux trace is how you need to capture the flow, then in that case, a manual dump can still be of some use. I guess the message there is to coordinate with your level 2 support if you're working at that level to determine what's actually required to diagnose the problem in your situation. Okay, on slide 24, we talk a little bit about internal and aux trace. In any case, if you want to track what's going on with your web services application, you need to make sure that your tracing is active and sized to at least 4 meg or 4000K. We recommend standard 1-2 level tracing for the EI, PG, PI, SO, and WB components, since those are so critical to web services processing. And then standard level all tracing for PG if you're at CSCSTS version 3.1 or lower. Now, all other tracing components should be specified at trace level 1, just so that we have an idea of what CSCS is generally doing. Now, in addition, I'd like to call your attention to some must-gather publications that we've published on the web. The must-gather is level 2's approach to saying if you're encountering a problem of a certain type, generally speaking, what type of information, what sort of documentation is going to be required by level 2 to further diagnose the problem. And that can be useful not only for level 2, but even on your own if you're trying to diagnose or understand your own problem. You can use those must-gather documents to look at level 2's approach and gather the same type of information, look at the same information that we would be looking at if we were investigating whatever problem that you're encountering. Now, some of the specific must-gather tech notes include a web services must-gather, which is tech note number 122-0283, SOAP for kicks must-gather document, and also a service flow runtime must-gather document. You see the numbers referenced there. Okay, slide 25. Now we're going to start getting into diagnosis techniques. And on to slide 26. Okay, now some of the non-standard methods, we've already talked a little bit about using Eclipse to validate your WSDL. If your application folks are trying to get a handle on the WSDL they've been supplied with, Eclipse also has some very nice tools to graphically display the design of a given WSDL. For a simpler approach, you can use Firefox, for example, to format a plain text WSDL. Now, it doesn't really give you any value other than, you know, properly indenting the WSDL to make it look pretty. I find Eclipse much more useful for understanding what a WSDL is about, but just to be aware that you can at least browse your WSDL using a Firefox browser for a different view of it. Now, most everybody, I think, in the Kix world is aware of the CEDF transaction. A relatively newer introduction is a transaction called CEDX. It's just like CEDF, but it allows the non-terminal oriented monitoring of transactions in a region. So, for example, where with CEDF you would specify CEDF space and then the four-character terminal ID that you want to monitor. In this case, with CEDX, you can specify the CEDX transaction space and then the name of the transaction that you wish to monitor. So in the case of a web services provider application that is receiving its data across the HTTP transport, you can type CEDX space CPIH and the next HTTP transport web services request that arrives in that CICS region is going to start off a CEDX, once again, the same as CEDF, session to allow you to step through your application and monitor its progress. So that can be handy for sort of a real-time examination of what's going on with your application. Okay, on slide 27. So, our diagnosis techniques, typically when we're looking at dumps, we're using the Kix verb exit. We'll specify the proper verb exit for the version of CSCS that we're running at, DFH PD 630, 640, or 650. Typically, for web services related problems, we're looking at kernel information, KE equals 3, to look at the tasks that are present in the dump region, to show the stack for the tasks, and often with the stack we can determine at what point in processing and which specific tasks we're interested in looking further at. And the kernel error display, K-E-R-R, will also display, reveal if the dump symptom cascaded from an earlier error. And just a reminder to keep focused on the root cause, because a lot of times the problem that pops up in our faces isn't really the first problem that occurs for a particular transaction, and most typically you're going to want to look at that root cause. The DS equals 3 verb exit parameter allows us to look at dispatch information in case we're looking at hang or other performance-related problems. Some other verb exits that we would find useful very typically are WB for the web interface data, SO for sockets, PI for pipelines, and PG for program manager, which now includes the container information related to particular transactions as well. Okay, slide 28, please. Now, one of my favorite areas of verb exit usage is in some of the trace techniques that you can use. Especially with web services, this can be very handy for diagnosing problems that you're experiencing. So, as I have listed there, there's a sample trace request with the IPCS verb exit, where you specify the proper verb exit depending on the release that you're running. So that would be verbex space DFH PD 650. And then in single quotes, TR equals 2 tells the kick verb exit to display full trace listing. The TRS now is a subcommand of the TR verb exit command that allows us to enter additional trace subcommands. Now, beyond the TRS command or option, the other sub-options that are specified are the same as you would specify in the batch CSS trace utility program. So in this case, type TR equals SO0201-0202 XM1101 DF0002 allows us to display only those type of trace entries. And it's equivalent to the command that I show in the second sample, the sample trace with the CSS trace utility. Now, the internal trace is typically associated with a particular addend or an identifying situation, such as an error message that can trigger the dump. Aux trace can be used for problems, as we've already talked about, that produce no known external symptoms, but you know you're encountering a problem in here somewhere. So aux trace is sort of like using a big hammer or a big net, if you will, to capture everything going on in your region at a given time frame to be able to drill down further into what specific problems that you're having. Now remember, your trace data sets fill up very quickly. So sizing considerations, it's better to have it too big than not big enough. Obviously, there are limits to that suggestion or to that advice, but generally we want them larger than we need. Okay, now on slide 29, here's an example that I've drawn up, and I find this especially helpful with web services to really get your bearing on the problem that you're looking at in a web services setting. By specifying a limited or abbreviated trace, in batch you'd say a breeze, or with the TRS subcommand in the verb exit, you could specify TR equals 1. You specify the type trace entries that I have listed there, the XM1101, DF0002, etc. That's going to show you all of the task attaches, as well as the initial program links and subsequent program links or transfer controls that basically map the way your program is executed. Now you're going to see some indentation on the example on this slide 29. I did that for your own benefit. In an actual trace listing, you're going to find everything towards the middle of the trace format is all going to be column aligned with that CWXN and DFHWBXN and all of those straight down. But I've indented here to show you where we've linked to a program DFHPIDSH, where that program has linked to another program DFHPISN1, and where we've returned from different programs as well. So it can help us to, if you have a rather complicated application, web service provider application, this can help you to see where you are in the processing when you're encountering problems. It's a good way to get a bead on what your processing looks like. Okay, on slide 30, so the sockets domain is another area that I really like to focus on. We're going to try and push through this pretty quick. The socket entries display the inbound and outbound data streams. It can be useful for pinpointing the tasks that need further investigation, but also identifying the specific problem that you want to look at. Identifying the performance characteristics of the processing by looking at the timing of the sends and the receives, and also for looking at the SOAP fault information. Because, yes, even though the SOAP fault is going to be deployable by your web service requester, we're going to see it in the trace on the socket send request. So the data stream focus, when you're looking at the socket's domain, is to look at the SO0201 and SO0202 entries. Now, SO0201 is socket send or socket receive. It's the entry to that trace point. SO0202 is the exit from that trace point. But what's interesting here is that depending on whether you're doing a send or a receive, that's going to influence where you're actually going to see this data. On a socket send, and you picture this from a CITS perspective, on a socket send request, when we do the send, we know what data we're going to send. And so you'll see that send data mapped on trace argument 2 of the SO0201, the entry to the socket send request. However, on a socket receive request, since we don't know what data we got until we exit that socket receive request, we don't see it on the entry, on the SO0201 trace entry. We actually see it on the exit, SO0202. We'll show the data associated with receive requests. Okay, and on the next couple slides, we're going to illustrate that. On slide 31, this is just a listing of all the socket activity at an abbreviated level. So we have one line per trace entry. As you can see from the sequence numbers on the right-hand side, there is some skipping around. And I've highlighted and underlined a couple of entries here. There's entry number 52169 that shows an exit from a socket receive. Now, since this is an abbreviated display, we don't actually see the data, but we're just getting our bearings in this example. And then just below that, at trace entry 53412, there's an entry to the socket send. Once again, it's abbreviated, you don't see the data, but if you display with TR trace equals 2 for that trace entry point, then you'll see the data that was actually associated with that request as well. Now on to slide 32. So this is a little bit more focused, if you will. We're not looking at all the socket entries. Now we're just looking at SO0201 and O202. So you can see sort of the sequence, and we're seeing for, really there's three tasks that are listed. There's task number 00004, which is going to be associated with CSOL, the socket's listener. So the socket's listener has placed a reserve for transaction 428 to do a receive. In other words, the socket's listener has detected there's data that needs to be received, and the transaction CPIA should be attached to receive that data. Here you see the receives pulling the data in. There's a commit that's done as the CWSN transaction is now going to invoke the web services task, CPIH, which is invoked here as task number 429. And then you see in task 429, as the web services processing is complete, we do the send back out and close that socket once again. Now, I know I've given you more information really than the trace is showing, but I'm trying to give some context with you so that you can follow along, and more is going to be revealed over the next couple slides here. So on to slide 33, now we've listed in detail, that is TR equals 2, both the socket receive entries, the exit from the socket receive call. And there in argument 2, in the clear text, in the iCatcher data to the right side, you'll see both the header information as well as the SOAP envelope in the second trace entry down below. On the slide 34, as I said, on the socket receives, you see that data on the exit from the socket call. However, on the socket send, you see on entry. So in trace entry SO0201, there's a socket send request, and below in argument 3 and argument 4, you see the header and the envelope data associated with that socket send request. Okay, to slide 35, please. Now, one of the other areas that merits a lot of inspection with web services processing is the containers. Web services tends to do a lot of work with containers. And there's some very handy tracing commands that allow you to see not only the manipulation of various containers, but also the contents. So if you're running with PG 1-2, then the PG1910 and PG1912 trace points will be available to you. And as you can see from the example below, that will display not only the container name in trace points WB, Foxfox 60, PG1900, but they're also showing the first 256 bytes as shown in the trace example below PG1910. On the slide 36, this mentions some additional important trace entries that can be useful for looking at web services related problems. The AP4800 trace entry displays data conversion information, pipeline details in the pipeline domain, and you can really look at all the entries in the pipeline, and HTTP data you'll see in the WB0410 trace point. Now, some sample problems starting on page 37 and actually on to 38. We're going to take you through three quick examples. There's first is a web services failure, actually a failure that I encountered when I attempted to set the web services sample application up on my own system here. Second, a data conversion error, one that I actually caused to happen, but I wanted to illustrate an error. And then the third one, kind of interesting, the DFHPI 1008 incorrect input was actually an error that I encountered where I was trying to diagnose a problem for another person. And using the techniques that I have tried to highlight or to describe in this presentation allowed me to quickly get to the bottom of that problem. And it had an interesting resolution I think you'll appreciate. Slide 39. So problem one, web services failure. The background and the symptoms. What we saw happening, we were trying to configure and use a new web service. I already described it's the catalog manager, the sample app that Kix provides with web services. What we found when we tried to implement that was that web services wasn't functional, and if you made a web service request, then you'd receive a 500 internal server error. Now, the Kix message user log reports the message after a few user after the user tries to call the web service, and the message was DFHWB0725 that says web attached processing detected an error linking to the analyzer user replaceable module none. So it kind of looks like something's not properly set up, not properly configured. And what I found when I looked further into it was that the web service and URI map definitions weren't automatically generated when I did my CEDA install pipeline. Now, if you recall, when I was earlier talking about the structure of web services, most people will allow their web service and URI map definitions to dynamically be defined, to allow the pipeline install to automatically generate those definitions. And that's what I did here, but my attempt to generate those dynamically wasn't successful. So here's where we start getting into the problem a little bit further. On the next slide, slide 40. First thing I did was to check the CHS system log. Didn't see any messages in the console log. However, message user contained a series of messages when the pipeline itself was actually installed. And a particular note, about halfway down that group of messages, you're going to see a DFHPI 0705 message. It says, pipeline EXPIPE 01 encountered an error writing the configuration to the derived shelf. Well, that's pretty straightforward, and in fact, if you look at the HFS return codes for the writes, you'll see that that code of 0000006 FOX is equivalent to permission is denied. Now, on the slide 41, digging deeper into this, and not that you necessarily need to, but if you want to use all of the resources at your disposal to really fully understand what was going on here, you could have a look at trace to more fully understand the problem. And when you look at the actual pipeline install itself, there's an entry that shows we're about to make the HFS, to create the HFS directory, and there in the iCatcher is the name of the directory that we want to create, and there's the trace exception that shows reason not authorized. And so really it's little more than confirmation of what we've already diagnosed to this point. Now in 42, the message user output also show that the original error was in fact recognized by CICS when the pipeline was initially installed, even though the install itself worked. So here I've captured some information, and those of you that use CEDA will recognize this display. Here I've attempted to do an install on my pipeline called EXPIPE01, and within CEDA, over to the right-hand side, you're going to see install successful. That's exactly what I saw when I tried to install this pipeline. However, when I went back to CEMT, to the master terminal display, to look at the pipeline, I could see that it was installed, that is to say it was defined, but the status was set to disabled due to the errors encountered during the pipeline scan. So there's the inquiry of the pipeline. Pipeline ESPIPE01 is disabled, and it's unknown whether it's a provider or a requester pipeline because the install wasn't successful. So CEDA says install successful, and what that means is, yes, I've defined your pipeline for you. But when you look at a pipeline as a static pipeline definition along with a dynamic web service and URI map definition, that conglomeration, if you will, was not successful, and that's really what's being reflected here. On to page 43, so to resolve the error, we addressed the problem, identified the error message, and then either request a new scan by reinstalling the pipeline or just by rescanning the existing pipeline. So if you reinstall, you'd use CEDA to do the install of your pipeline. To rescan, you can actually do a master terminal CEMT perform pipeline scan, and that will cause the same mechanism to run. The lessons learned from this, just because CEDA reports a pipeline install successful, doesn't mean it was a complete installation. And the other lesson is that message user can be a valuable source of diagnostic information, but you might still need trace to learn some additional important details. Okay, on to slide 44 and problem number 2. Here's the sample data conversion error. Now, the background and symptoms, all we were seeing in this case was a message, DFHPI1009, that says message processing failed, a conversion error, invalid character occurred when converting field, CA item ref rec. Now, that's pretty handy. The error message itself is actually telling us why it encountered an error and what field it encountered the error for. So that CA item ref rec is probably going to come in handy a little bit later. We'll kind of keep that in mind as we go through this problem. On to slide 45. As we start to diagnose this problem, one of the things that we started looking at was in the kernel domain. We looked at the stack associated with the CPAH task that was actually attempting to provide that web service. And as you look through the stack, and I've, of course, highlighted it for your benefit, but you can see that this transaction was starting to do some parse XML, tried to do some convert data, and then took a dump. So that's kind of consistent with what it was saying about it encountered a problem with conversion, and here, in fact, in the stack, you can see that that's very true. Now, as you're looking through the stacks, you will see different CICS applicator or CICS provided programs listed off to the side of the stack as we go through invoking those different programs. The KIX Diagnosis Reference Manual provides short descriptions of the modules that we see here, in particular the pipeline modules. We can see that DFHPISN, for example, is used for SOAP node support. DFHPIPM is the pipeline manager domain gate, and so on. So if you have questions about what the programs are and what sort of functions that they're providing, you can find that information, generally speaking, in the diagnosis reference. Now on slide 46, when we looked at our web service requester application, which was non-CICS, actually I used Eclipse to make that request, CICS returned a SOAP fault to that web service request, and that SOAP fault included the same information that we saw in message user. If you look down towards about the bottom third of that SOAP envelope, you're going to see the same DFHPI1009 message that we saw in message user. And it identifies that same field, CA item ref rec. Now, On slide 47, and this is just a slight departure, I've mentioned this in a couple presentations that I've already done, but I'm just trying to get the word out, that as we move into more of an ASCII world, not strictly EBCDIC, IPCS is keeping up with this nicely in allowing us to display data in CICS in a ZOS dump that may not be in EBCDIC format. And it does that with a keyword called ASCII. So in this example, let's assume that I'm browsing data. My raw data is listed to the left-hand side of this chart. And typically, the default is that the eye-catcher information that's going to be displayed for that data is going to be an EBCDIC. So this is going to be an EBCDIC interpretation of the raw data that you see to the left-hand side. However, the data that came in, I have EBCDIC data in the envelope, in the header, but the envelope data is not displayable, as you can see, in the EBCDIC format at the very bottom of that column. But if you look over in the ASCII format column, you're going to see that ASCII data now is properly interpreted. SOAP envelope, envelope, XMLNS, and et cetera, et cetera. And the way you can switch that eye-catcher display back and forth is simply by editing or by typing in the command EBCDIC or ASCII, depending on how you want that eye-catcher data to be displayed. So that's, a handy tool. Okay, on slide 48, we talk a little bit about the PG domain. Our dump included information that showed the PG domain, that showed the different containers that were being used. So to look at the data that's actually being used, or that is contained in that container, that is present in that container, you can look at the address specified by an offset of hex 30 into the CRCB. So for example, to display the contents of the container DFHWS body with a length of hex 2.9, you can use the IPCS command locate or list the address that's listed, 156.49818, that's associated with the DFHWS body container, plus 30, and then the question mark says, take me to that address that's specified at the offset 30 from that. And I want you to display the data for a length of hex 2.9. And that will display for you in IPCS the container data associated with that DFHWS body container. Now on slide 49, as we look in fact at the DFHWS body container that has the SOAP body included in it, we can see CA item ref rec. And this is, if you look in the eye-catcher data, it's about 8 lines down, and you'll have an entry, open tag CA item ref rec, and then there's the contents of that item, and the content is capital B-I-L-L. And then there's the end tag for CA item ref rec. That just allows us to look to see what the actual data was contained by that data value. And now on slide 50, here in this example we've taken a quick look at the WSDL, the Web Services Definition Language, that describes that element, the CA item ref rec. And we can see in that WSDL that the definition, and I've actually highlighted it near the bottom of the screen, XSD restriction, the base equals XSD unsigned short, says that this field should be a numeric value. And as we saw in the actual SOAP envelope, it's not numeric. In fact, it's alphabetic. It's somebody's name, Bill. And so the reason we got a conversion error in this case was that we provided a non-numeric value to a field that's defined strictly as numeric. Now on slide 51, our final problem. Problem 3, DFHPI1008, incorrect input. Now this one kind of surprised me a little bit, but using the techniques that I've already talked about in this presentation, I was able to diagnose the problem relatively quickly, and I think you'll see, you know, how that happened as I go through this example. So the problem that was reported, the customer was attempting to upgrade their CICS region from TS3.1 to 3.2. They found that nearly all web services functions migrated without error. There was one exception. A single web service provider application was encountering these consistent DFHPI1008 messages. And the error said, the task, SOAP message generation failed because of incorrect input, and then the additional message, input structure too small. So the customer provided a system dump that was triggered by the DFHPI 1008 message and requested additional assistance. So what we did, starting on slide 52, first thing I did was to get my bearings. Based on what the customer described to me, I did a TR equals 2 listing, and then I searched for the symptom code of DFHPI 1008, or in this case, just PI 1008, to find that error message and where it was occurring in the trace. And that gave me the task number that it was associated with. So now I could take a little bit closer look at that specific task, and looking at the pipeline, I could see the entry to parse, the data would be displayed. Now this is just an abbreviated listing, but here's where we would be listing the outbound comm area data, and then there we have the exception entry, input error, input structure too small. Now, what is that input structure too small? What does that mean? Well, looking it up in our CICS manual, it's described as a message is given when the container that's passed to CICS doesn't hold sufficient data given the length of the language structure. In other words, when we provide our response to the web service request, this is a web service provider that sends an output message in response. And that message that we were trying to send back was too small. We weren't sending enough data. Okay, so that caused me to ask the question, what is the data that's actually being passed for parsing? And there I saw on trace entry PI 0FOX06, on the outbound comm area data, it's also listed above, but now we're listing in detail the one line that consists of an EBCVIC ABC 9999 and then some additional numbers. Okay, marginally interesting, we're getting our bearings on it. Let's go to slide 53 and see where we went from here. Next, I wanted to look at the overall flow. You remember I talked about that earlier in this presentation. For getting your bearings on where your processing is, SIM 1101, DS0002, et cetera, these will show you as the tasks are invoked and as different programs are linked or transfer control under that task. This will show us the flow of control. So I listed that out, and as I was going through, let's see, what data was passed to the program that had the link failure? Okay, here we are, and I'm skipping over a part. In the first bullet on this slide, what's the overall task flow? You're going to notice as you look through that task flow, you have an initial link exec OK, there's some more linking, and then there's a link to a program called Cust Apple. That's three lines from the bottom of that top section. And then right below that, you have an exit from the link exec with an exception. So digging further into the program that had the link failure, looking at the data that was passed to that program, I see the same data, ABC 99999 0502, some additional numeric data. This caused me to sort of generate a theory, if you will, because what I was seeing happen was that this web service provider application was being invoked. It tried to link to a program, Cust Apple, got a link failure, and shortly after that, returned from the web services request with the same data that it attempted to link to this remote program that it got the failure with. In other words, it seemed as though this link to program CUSTAPPL was supposed to somehow manipulate this data, this ABC 99999 0502, etc. It failed, and the web service processing then took that data that hadn't been modified and passed it back as the web services request. So, on to slide 54, the follow-up, if you will. At that point, I called the customer, asked about that remote program, Cust Apple. I explained that what the dump's internal trace showed us, what my working theory was, and the requirements for a new dump if analysis to this point didn't identify the error. But the customer came back and they said, oh, you know what, based on what you said about Cust Apple, we found that there was a missing resource group which was causing that program not to be called successfully. Once they properly defined Cust Apple, that web services error disappeared. So, the lessons learned from this example, first of all, it's very worthwhile to get the lay of the land. You need to ask the right kinds of questions. Is this a web service provider? Is it a requester? Has it worked before? Does it work all the time? Does it fail all the time? Does it fail only in certain circumstances? But ask those types of questions about processing, about the flow of the application to better understand what the requirements are and to improve your odds of being able to diagnose that problem. And make sure you ask lots of questions. Okay, on slide 55, now we're getting into some references related to this material. On page 56, I've made a lot of references to the KIX web support page and the tech notes that we generate on a constant basis. The general format for your tech notes is shown there on the tech notes highlight. So you can take any of the tech note numbers and plug them into the NNNNNN at the end of that sample web page to display any of those tech notes that are listed. And some very useful ones are shown there. Support for white space and variable length values, how to read a WSL. One of the ones that I'd actually strongly encourage you all to have a look at is the third one listed under the tech notes highlight, testing CICS web services. That's a tech note written by Paul Cooper from our Hersley Labs that describes in detail how to use Eclipse, RDZ or WDZ for that matter will work the same. But in this case, we're using Eclipse to actually test our web services, that is, to act as a web service requester to allow us to define the data that we want to pass off and the URI that we want to use to pass that web service request off to. If you'll remember earlier in the presentation, I was talking about how browsers don't know web services. They don't understand how to talk web services. Well, Eclipse does, and that can be a very handy way of testing your web services mechanisms from outside of your CICS region. Now, there are other related tech notes out there. You can do searches, even if you don't have the tech note highlight, or excuse me, the tech note number, to find if the problem that you're encountering has previously been encountered, or perhaps to find some hints about how to diagnose that problem. Okay, on to slide 57, please. There's some additional red books that are listed here. There has been a wealth of information published about web services in books beyond the standard CICS set of manuals that are provided. In particular, the Implementing CICS Web Services Handbook and the Securing CICS Web Services books could be very useful. Now on slide 58, some additional publications that I referenced in putting this presentation together in the Socket domain. The AIOCB is a control block that's embedded in the socket's listener table entry and a description of how to read, how to understand that control block for TCP/IP communication can be found in the ZOS Unix System Services Programming Assembler Callable Services Reference Guide. The return codes for HFS file activity that you saw earlier in example one of the problems that I've diagnosed here can be found in the ZOS Unix System Services Messages and Codes Manual. Now on to slide 59. Some additional references. The webcast library has numerous technical presentations that you can have a look at by going to that web address. Presentations included in web services, KIX Plex, file control, Java, storage, etc. A lot of different topics out there, a lot of ways to increase your education and knowledge. And now on to slide 60 for some additional product resources. And at this point, I'm going to turn the presentation back over to Joseph.
Thank you, Charlie, for a great presentation. At this point, Jody, we would like to open the lines for questions.
We do have a question from Pat Gwynn. Your line is open.
Hi, I just wanted to confirm that the WSL that gets built and put on the ZFS or HFS structure, is that used at all during runtime?
Not during runtime unless you're doing validation.
Okay. So that's the only time we really need to make sure that if we're not dynamically installing the RMAP and web service, that if we're hard coding it or statically defining it, we want to point to that where that WSL is.
Right.
If we're going to use validation.
That's right. That's correct.
And then what's your suggestion about moving WS spine files, if we have like don't share DASI, if we're moving it from one system to another, how should we move those WS spine files, because we're not going to use the web assistant to put it into production?
Okay, and actually I was recently dealing with another customer that was running through something similar. As long as the file itself doesn't exceed certain size considerations, that is, if it's less than 32K, you can use OGIT and OPUT to read the data from HFS and to put it back in and then transmit it, I guess, using ZOS, using non-HFS. You can transmit it to your other system and then use, I guess it's OPUT, to put the data back into HFS format. The other thing you can do, though, and without, I don't think that there are size constraints here, you can actually use FTP to move the data from one node to another.
And then my last question is, if we actually want to see the name of the transaction or web service instead of CPIH, is there now a parameter we can use when we run the web assistant to tell it what transaction to run under?
Yes, as a matter of fact, there is. I think it's just TransID, and I don't have that information right here with me, but I think just the TransID parameter on the web services assistant will do that for you.
Okay, thank you very much.
You bet.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Craig Tatarin. Your line is open, sir.
Hi there. First, I'd like to say great presentation. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Greg.
One of the things that we've run into, one of the limitations of web services on Kix is its non-support for XSD choice. I was just wondering if you had anything, to say about, working around that limitation or not.
Actually, I don't have any experience in that area.
Okay.
And I haven't seen anything written about it either.
Okay, I did. We were getting an error when we were trying to import a WSDL, and it said basically it led us to a tech note saying XSD choice is not supported. So
okay.
It kind of stopped us in our tracks.
Yeah.
So, anyways, that was my question.
Okay. Yeah. Sorry, don't have more information for you on that. Is that? I mean, if that's a requirement, you might consider submitting a marketing requirement.
Okay.
To at least, make that need recognized.
Gotcha. Thank you.
All right.
We do have another question from Paul Masters. Your line is open, sir.
On the trace entries, I know that we're now seeing a lot more data. You mentioned like the input and output fields, and you said it only showed like 255 characters. Is that all that's actually in the trace record? That is, does it really limit the amount of data in the trace, or does it really collect the whole amount, but we only see a certain amount?
You're talking about for the container display?
Well, yeah, specifically because that's what you're talking about, but I've seen that other places that it shows data, so.
Yeah, I think we're only actually gathering the first 256 bytes in that case.
Okay.
So that even if there's more data out there, you're not going to see that actually in trace.
Okay, but that isn't collected. And we just don't see it. It's just all that's collected is that small amount.
That's right.
As you know, some of that stuff can be very large.
Yes, it can. And all that's actually passed to the trace request actually is the first 256 bytes.
Yeah. Alrighty, thank you.
You bet.
We have no further questions.
Thank you, Jody. At this time, we will conclude the presentation.